Hey, welcome along to another full hour of live questions from Mark Stein Club members around the planet. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time. That means 9 p.m. in London and in Algiers, where they've just gotten rid of the discredited old leader, long past any usefulness. No, that's Algiers where they've done that, not London. 10 p.m. in Paris, Berlin, and Khartoum, where the whiff of revolution is in the air for the local strongman, Bashir, in the Sudan. 11 p.m. in Jerusalem, where the polls have closed about an hour ago in Israel's election, and I see contradictory evidence from the various exit polls. Looks like a tight race, but if we do get any breaking developments in the next hour, we may bring them to you. And we are here, as I said, to take your questions. If you're not a member of the Mark Stein Club, you can always join. We're coming up to our second birthday, and we're here to stay. And if you like to sign up, we will make a special effort to get your question in right now on this very first show before the top of the hour. Rich writes, Mark, back-to-back weeks of the Q&A, my cup runneth over. And Rich is he's my fellow Granite Stater. He says, my sliver of southern New Hampshire is filled with conservative SKPs from Massachusetts. Not sure what particular sliver that is. A lot of slivers in southern New Hampshire are filled with a lot of big-time liberal Democrat voters. But nice to know your sliver has conservative SKPs from Massachusetts. Being that last weekend was the first with pleasant weather since fall, my neighbours and I were cleaning up our yards and getting reacquainted with one another. Trump came up a few times in conversation, and everyone, myself included, said the same thing. We wish he would focus on cutting spending, but he's our guy. I go to church with a lot of these sorts of folks as well, people who may not like him and certainly didn't vote for him in the primary. But he's the one between us and the loonies. And I think this gets to your point about the sweet spot moving, specifically the cultural shift from liberal to conservative. It can be difficult to win a political debate about marginal tax rates, supply side economics, blah, blah, when the other party is using words like equality and fairness. But when Democrats prioritize issues such as the validity of men having periods, transgender sports, and what chicken sandwiches are acceptable to eat, there isn't anywhere for a sane voter to go but right. There's a lot of truth to that. Trump is essentially a post-partisan figure in that respect. I always say this, if you go back to 2015 when he came down that escalator, and you're in the fancy bit of New Hampshire, Rich. You're not in the broken down loser part where the town's died. And if your town has died, you can't, sort of philosophical purity, theoretical purity is a luxury you can't afford. You might, a person can have a philosophical commitment to private health care, more choice, being able to pick out what plan you need from Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Blue whatever. But if you actually happen to fall off the roof and you don't have anything, you're screwed and you need someone to repair your broken back. And there's a lot that is essentially the state of what a lot of the country that provided Trump's margin of victory in the Rust Belt states. That's the situation. Those people who provided his victory were in that situation. It's not a conservative or liberal thing. When you listen to the Republicans, you know, you've got Lindsey Graham wanting to put boots on the ground in countries you've never heard of. When you switch on, as you said, the Democrats, they're not talking about women's rights or civil rights from the South or Hispanic rights or gay rights. They actually talk about micro demographics you've never encountered. And this is, it's a very strange, the point I made on Tucker last night, I said I'd expand a little bit. I was talking about these guys, and your Massachusetts neighbours, Rich, will be familiar with them because there's a lot of them in Massachusetts. It was a thing about 10, 15 years ago, the fiscally conservative, socially liberal Republican. That's the only kind you have in Massachusetts. That's what Mitt Romney was before he decided to run for president. That Paul Salucci, Bill Weld, who I think actually is running for president again this year. I don't know what for some wacky new party or something. And you had them elsewhere. George Pataki in New York, Christy Todd Whitman in New Jersey. Fiscally liberal and social conservative. And I never particularly liked it at the time because the trouble is that, you know, when push comes to shove, and they have to resolve the internal contradictions between fiscally conservative, socially liberal, the social liberalism wins every time, because it turns out you can't. It's very hard to be fiscally conservative with social liberalism, because the social liberalism comes with quite a price tag. And I suggested to Tucker last night, and you see this, you can sort of discern it with Trump, because Trump doesn't really talk about the deficit much. You can, when he ran, he was talking about immigration rather than debt, for example. You can see it in some of the European elections. You can see it in Brexit. You can see it in what's happened in Italy and Austria. You can see it with Marine Le Pen in France. You can see it with some of these new parties emerging in Scandinavia, who are basically fiscally liberal but culturally conservative. They don't actually want to disturb the post-Second World War social democratic state in Europe. But they, at the same time, they don't want to invite billions, the other 6.5 billion people in the non-Western world to come in and overwhelm that social democratic state. And it seems to me that the ground is actually shifting. The ground is actually shifting in quite a big way. In some of these things. You know, someone like Marine Le Pen, for example, who's damned as right wing, she actually isn't in any sense that most Americans would recognize right wing when it comes to, say, healthcare or welfare programs or anything like that. She's right wing. What makes her right wing, supposedly, is that she doesn't want to she doesn't want France to be overwhelmed and become unrecognizably French. So that's the kind of thing I was talking about when I was saying fiscally liberal and culturally conservative. And Bernie Sanders occasionally shows a few signs of going there, as I was talking about with Tucker. P. Gow writes, years ago, the writer Florence King, she was the very funny lady who wrote for National Review. She was a lady, although she had a sort of tart wit when it came to matters sexual that always made her fun to read. Florence King archly panned the fashion industry's peculiar sudden trend to show models posed with these gaping-mouthed hysterics, by which a sort of permanent state of so much fun and, of course, so much better than average people's fun. Years later, in 2019, tonsils and that fleshy flapping. I think are you talking about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's mouth? That's a bit unladylike, P. Gow. I'm not sure we want to go there. But the I thought you were talking about heroin chic, those kind of fashion models. Robert writes, the comments to the Heather has two imams piece. This was yesterday's edition of Mark's Mailbox. Hope you'll check it out, because some of the questions came from last week's Clubland Q&A. The comments included an item on Lara Logan's ordeal during the early days of the Arab Spring, which reminded me of the covering up issue affecting all women, whether Muslim or not, in emerging Muslim majority areas in European cities. Would it be possible for you to put together a brief compilation of examples from European cities to give those of us surrounded by Islamophilic liberals some extra material? Thanks in advance. Well, you're referring to this phenomenon that once, you know, multiculturalism, diversity is the interim phase. So if you take these certain European neighbourhoods, Clichy-sous-Bois, for example, let's start with France, Clichy-sous-Bois. If you were there 70 years ago, it was French, ethnic French. And then it began to get a Muslim population, in part because of French government policy. And then so that seems diverse, because you've got like Jacques and François, a Micheline and Solange, and then you've got Ahmed and Fatima and Mohammed, and it's all much more diverse than it used to be. But then it gets a bit problematic. And so Jacques and François and Micheline and Solange start moving out. And the area becomes more and more Muslim. And then if you're one of the non-Muslim women there, it becomes a little more difficult just walking around in the evening. And so I mentioned this phenomenon in America Alone and have touched on it from time to time. Non-Muslim women start going covered to avoid being harassed by the excitable young Muslim men. And I saw that in Molenbeek, in Brussels a couple of years ago, which has become wholly Muslim. And you can still see ethnic European couples strolling around there in the day. But once the sun goes down, you don't. And the streets become the province. I saw this actually in Toulouse too. Same thing in Toulouse. There are streets where the French women in Toulouse or the Belgian women in Molenbeek don't go after dark. And if they do go there, if they have to go there, they sort of go in semi-disguise. They'll put on a headscarf. They won't go there. Toulouse, for example, during the day, I was there in the summer, and it's quite nice, actually. You forget how lovely it is when you with young French demoiselles bicycling through the streets in shorts and little striped T-shirts, all very fair. But you wouldn't. There's certain streets you don't walk down in shorts and a striped T-shirt after dark, and instead you'll see them go in head-to-toe clothing and with a scarf tied round the head, like the Queen going to the races. But they understand the rules. And then you take it to the next stage, like Malmö in Sweden. I always talk about walking from Malmö to Rosengård. And the big point there about Rosengård is they've got Muslims from all over the Muslim world there. They've got Muslims from places like Bosnia. From the stands, from the shishi little Gulf statelets. They've got women there, Albania. They've got women there who did not go covered in their home countries, and then when they emigrate to Sweden and wind up living in Rosengård, they find that they're obliged to go covered. That's how crazy it is. You could be an uncovered Muslim in Bosnia, and then you emigrate because of the war and everything. It's all a nightmare. So you emigrate to Sweden, and suddenly you got to go covered. It's a bizarre phenomenon. Mari writes, my apologies for this question, but do you have any thoughts on the influence of the Duchess of Sussex and her embrace of trendy things, including, as it has been reported, her wearing of mystical crystals in public? What does it say for the future of the royal family? I can't see it's a positive thing, but it seems where the trend line is going. Well, you know, when I watched that ghastly royal wedding, and I don't begrudge a chap finding love where he does. Prince Harry seems in many ways a splendid fellow. He was popular with his comrades when he was serving in the army, and he's always very moving and when he's on military occasions. I have no problem with him in that respect at all. And when I saw that wedding, which I thought was hilariously awful, I thought, God bless Her Majesty. You know, the Queen is a survivor, and this is the way you do it. This is like outwoking. You know, so when they had that like crazy, ludicrous preacher guy there going on and on, you know, and whatever, what is it, Stand By Me? They did the Benny King song. And I always say, having had some small acquaintanceship with the Duke of Edinburgh over the years, that I hope he was in good form at the reception afterwards. And I hope he went up to the singers and went, I thought that song about standing went on a bit long. I certainly hope it was like that. And I thought, this is fantastic. This is why the Queen's a survivor. She's outwoking the wokiest of the woke with this wedding. And then I read in the paper that Harry and Meghan, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, are going to raise their kid as gender neutral. So that at some point, I don't even know how you do that in the royal family, because normally they announce that the kid is either His Royal Highness or Her Royal Highness. I don't know how you could just be whatever. What is it? Je Royal Highness, until the kid's settled on what he or she wants to be. And then I thought, wait a minute, this is all like a giant leg pull. And I don't know where they're going on this. But it is either a giant leg pull or something wacky is going on with the Duchess of Sussex. Michael Seth writes, "Hi, Mark. I'm compiling my summer reading list. Could you please provide some of your favourite popular historical novels, hopefully without any reference to cultural decline or cockwombles? I'm thinking more James Clavell than James Joyce. Thanks, Mike Seth of Rockaway, New Jersey." I don't think James Joyce counts as historical novels, do they? I think they were, that's contemporary Dublin, although I'm not sure it's Dublin as any actual Dubliner has quite experienced it. My whole thing it doesn't always have to be cultural decline. I always like, I like the little, obviously I like the Flashman novels because of their huge, George MacDonald Fraser, the huge amount of historical detail in them. And I think it's a terrific way. For example, if you want to learn about Afghanistan, George Flashman's adventures in Afghanistan will certainly tell you more about that actual country and those people than wasting your time with that stupid Three Cups of Tea book that the Pentagon gave to every soldier, put it in the kit bag of every soldier shipping out to Afghanistan. Completely stupid, complete waste of time, completely ludicrous book. And they would have much been better off tucking Flashman into the kit bags of every GI headed out that way. And P.G. Woodhouse, I think the first of Fraser, George MacDonald Fraser, I met him once, and he was exactly the kind of chap you'd want him to be. But I think he wrote the first book. It must have come out about like late 60s was the first Flashman one. And P.G. Woodhouse wrote, I think he wrote to Guy Bolton. He said it's that pleasure. He said the book gives you that pleasure of knowing that this is the start of a whole world you are just going to love being part of. And I think that's true of those Flashman books. And it's immensely, it's not just Afghanistan, Madagascar, his view of Madagascar. So you can't do worse than start there. Jill Felsen wrote, "Hi, Mark, what do you think will be the consequences of the corruption scandal in Canada? Bonus question, will Brexit actually happen? Do the voters have any power left? Best Jill." The question now, I think the bloom is off Justin's row. By the way, I should say, my dear friend, and if you saw me at, I have huge reason to be grateful to Julian Porter. QC, because you couldn't ask for a better QC in my troubles with the Canadian Human Rights Commissions. And at the British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal, he and I had, because as he said, I'm a bit mercurial. So he and I had a bit of difficulty. We had a bit of a fractious relationship when we were actually, it was the week of the trial. And at one point, I got a message early one morning that Julian didn't want me to come to court that day. And I thought, oh, to hell with you. And then I bumped into him in the street and he wanted to make sure I was, I came in and I heard his magnificent peroration, his closing argument to those ghastly, awful kangaroo court judges, where he referenced that stupid line about not shouting fire in a crowded theatre. And he said, oh yes, you have not only the right, when the theatre is on fire, you have not only the right to shout fire, but the duty. It was magnificent that day. And he's now representing Justin Trudeau, suing the leader of the opposition in Canada. And everyone, you know, I think it was Andrew Coyne today who said, this is either the most self-sabotaging defamation suit since Oscar Wilde sued the Marquess of Queensbury, or there is some method in Justin's madness. And I'll say this, that Julian Porter is not a mad guy. He's he's Canada's number one libel lawyer. This would not be happening if it was just Oscar Wilde and the Marquess of Queensbury, where basically Sir Edward Clarke, who was Wilde's QC, was actually completely in the day. He asked Wilde for an assurance that none of the sodomitical stuff, as I believe they referred to it in court, had actually happened, and Wilde gave him that assurance. So you can imagine that Sir Edward had quite a surprise midway through the second day of the trial. Putting that aside, though, I think the bloom is off Justin's rose. And throwing it back on Andrew Scheer in this lawsuit actually gets to the heart of the choice between facing Canada at the time of the election. It's like, it's going to be, okay, we've decided Justin, you know, he's not the 12-year-old boy king. He's not going to lead us to the new utopia. He's just the usual grubby Liberal Party hack. But are we comfortable with Andrew Scheer? Are we comfortable with Andrew Scheer? And actually, you know, it's no secret. He wasn't my guy in the leadership election. I thought he was such a... I mean, I interviewed a bunch of leadership candidates and I didn't even put him on the reserve list as someone I was interested in. I didn't even do joke. I did jokes, I think, about every single... Because I was on stage in Ottawa and immediately after a leadership debate, and various of the candidates had all left their notes on their podia on the stage, and I was just like randomly picking them up and doing jokes about them. I think one guy had written, remember to mention wife and children. I'm glad he'd written a note to himself. But I didn't even think Andrew Scheer was worth doing jokes about. That's how useless he was. So I think there's still an open question there. They're off Justin, but whether they're on Andrew Scheer. Brexit. Brexit is really a disgrace. It's basically open sabotage now. They are passing the House of Commons and the House of Lords have basically now passed into law a law forbidding a no deal Brexit. I don't believe they have the right to do that. I don't believe they have the right to do that. And at the same time, so we're now moving into a very legally dubious area in which you can't have a no deal Brexit, which means that essentially the European Union gets to impose what Brexit is. And you see now, she's begging, Theresa May is begging Macron. She was begging Macron today. She'll be begging the other leaders tomorrow to give her an extension. And I think they're going to give her an extension until the end of the year, but with written conditions that Britain cannot interfere in any of the operations of the European Union. For 45 years, Britain has been the awkward member of the European Union, the one that causes all the problems, the one that ensures it has to have opt-outs and carve-outs, and it won't go along with this, and it vetoes that, and it blocks this. And they're basically saying now, OK, you can stay in till the end of the year in a vassal status. And you know something? That's for them, that's the best of all worlds. They get the UK economy without the UK, without the UK's political objections to centralised government from Brussels. Theresa May, God rot the British Conservative Party. It's outlived it. It's outlived whatever usefulness it might have had. And the idea that, you know, we're supposed to be excited. Ooh, who'll be next after Theresa May? Who cares? If you're going to be a vassal state of the European Union, who cares who leads a minor political party in a minor northwestern province of a European superstate? To hell with Theresa May and God rot the UK Conservative Party. And let's see, Carl Lynn says, what is the current definition of far-right and alt-right? And why does the GOP put up with this nonsense? Carl, you're right. I spoke about this on Rush a few weeks ago with respect to Steve King. Steve King got into trouble for saying some things in an interview with the New York Times. His first mistake was agreeing to give an interview to the New York Times. His second mistake, when you give interviews to people who are only interviewing you in order to screw you over, is to insist on taping the whole thing and then posting the whole thing at your website so people can judge for themselves. But instead, Steve King gives an interview to the New York Times, and the New York Times types it up, and it purports to show him straying into white supremacist territory. And so, of course, all the GOP immediately rushed to dissociate themselves from that. In fact, if you look at what he said, one of the phrases he used was Western civilization. The GOP is dissociating itself from the concept of Western civilization. Well, thanks a lot, guys. Once you've done that, they're actually the whole thing with Republicans and UK conservatives, Canadian conservatives, whoever it is. Oh, this isn't the hill to die on, and that isn't the hill to die on, and that thing that the left is going to be on about a year or two from now, that won't be the hill to die on either. And until you eventually reach the state of the US Republican Party, where Western civilization isn't the hill to... In that case, there are no hills to die on. All the hills have gone. The enemy have taken all the hills, and you're down in the valley, like in some godforsaken corner of Helmand province in Afghanistan, while all the local herdsmen are just firing on you all day long, because you don't control any hills. All the hills have gone. And I don't know where this... I don't know where this whole thing, far-right, alt-right, and all the rest of it is. I know that the lesson from... I know that one of the lessons from Trump is we have to... And 2015, 2016, is that the left has assaulted language so that eventually a phrase like Western civilization becomes racist and white supremacist. So you can't say Western civilization. And we have to have the space to open up language, to reclaim language, because otherwise you can't talk about anything that's conservative. Once you pervert language to the degree that has happened in the last 15, 20 years, then there's no... You can't talk about any subject because every single debate you hold is framed in the left's terms. So there's no point. When you surrender language, you surrender everything. So Trump did a great service in 2015, 2016, just in opening up the possibilities of debate. And that's how I always look on it. So when I look at squish, rhino, useless, jelly-spined Republican congressman stampeding to condemn Steve King, I always look on it as the right colluding with the Democrats and the media in the shrinking of public discourse. And I think that's a tragedy, and it's partly responsible. If you don't like the far right or the alt-right or this right or that right, you're going to have a lot more of them in the future if you keep telling people, if you keep shrinking the bounds in which conversation takes place. It's a vital question. It's a very interesting question, Carl. Maybe we'll do a Steinpost or something about it, because it requires a big bit of a thought. Stuart Houston says, "Hi, Mark. After Obama was elected, my wife and I looked into moving to Australia, but their immigration policies are quite strict and we probably wouldn't qualify. I guess we could just go as tourists and overstay our visas. But my feeling is that if the United States does go down, there's no place in the world that's going to be pleasant to live in. Do you have any advice for potential emigres?" I wouldn't just go and overstay your visa, because actually Australia, no Western nation really has a serious immigration policy, but in some ways Australia's is the least unserious of all. And if you do actually overstay your, if you go in on a, whatever it is, a one-year visa, and then 1 year and 3 days later, you're flying out from Melbourne or Sydney or Perth or wherever, they'll actually ban you for life, I believe, if you've actually overstayed your visa by a couple of days. So I wouldn't think about doing that if you seriously want to live there. The place everyone always talks about, well, when the powder keg goes up, I'm going to New Zealand. That's kind of taken a hit in the reaction to what happened in Christchurch. You know, I mean, everyone thought that because New Zealand's a long way away, it's immune from the insanity of the rest of the English-speaking world and Europe. And it turns out that that's not to be true. The New Zealand rugby club, Crusaders, the New Zealand rugby team, the Crusaders, they're thinking, they've said that they're going to take soundings on whether to change their name, because it's offensive to people, apparently. And so some imam has said, well, they need to change their name. It's ridiculous they're even taking soundings. They should be abasing themselves. They should be groveling right now. They should already have changed their names. So even New Zealand, at the end of the earth, has got all the same rubbish that afflicts almost every other part of the Western world. And, the ANZAC services, for example, 60 of them have been cancelled due to so-called security concerns. So you can go to the Antipodes, but it's all following there. At some point, this is why I'm always reluctant. I said when I was speaking in the Danish Parliament, I really don't want to write off Denmark. You know, the one thing the Muslims have right is that once you're in the Dar al-Islam, you're in it forever. It's the Hotel California. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave. The Dar al-Islam, once you go through the door, that's forever. And I think it should be that way with the free world. So I have this idea that, let's write off Denmark and let's write off New Zealand and then let's write off Canada. And then, you know, actually pretty soon surrender. You know, again, it's the stupidity and parochialism of large parts of the American right that is my problem with them, because, you know, one of the reasons that They thought the conservatives, for example, in America, thought it was having a great streak in the Reagan years and afterwards, in the Gingrich years, that it could, that every couple of years they'd show that they had huge electoral strength. Meanwhile, the Democrats were playing for keep. Leftism, nothing liberal about it. This is actually, when you look at what they're teaching in not just universities, not just leftist universities, but in sort of run-of-the-mill grade schools in actually quite conservative red state areas, the left is actually playing for keeps and playing for all the stuff that matters. So conservatism now, there's a piece, and again, it's not just a particularly an American thing. There's a piece in the UK Spectator this week about the problems, the challenges, demographic and cultural, that the Conservative Party faces. Because when you surrender all the space, politics isn't where most people live. The culture is where most people live. So if you surrender the culture, because you're just giving money to some think tank that's lobbying in Washington for some visa that happens to suit the Koch brothers, don't be surprised that it becomes harder and harder every 2 years to drag a Republican over the finish line in November. That's why I don't like this hill to die on stuff. And it's why I said in the Danish parliament, I don't want to surrender Denmark. I don't want to surrender New Zealand. I really don't, because the idea that lonely outposts will survive is absurd. George Pazin, or Pazang, I don't know. Is he? I don't know. Let us know how you pronounce that, George. Maybe it's George. I don't know. George Pazin. Hi, Mark. Serious topic questions. Brexit, will it happen? US corruption, will it ever be addressed? More entertaining question. I know you're not a fan of the overly CGI'd superhero flicks, but I personally think these and the Harry Potter books and movies are the only way to introduce the masses to the timeless themes of good versus evil, individual rights, etc. If you look at almost every movie, and I do mean the actual movies, not the drivel their stars espouse, they're almost universally conservative in message. The bad guy in the Avengers film, Thanos, is pure Malthusian crap. Yet the Avengers are looking to stand up for every individual and not sacrifice to the collective while fighting this evil. Harry Potter is much the same in its exploration of good versus evil. Neville's speech at the end of the series is downright Churchillian. Are superhero and fantasy movies the only way remaining for the Hollywood folks to send a real message, albeit perhaps by accident? Well, it is by accident, because you know this if you listen to anything J.K. Rowling, the author of Harry Potter, says. Or I think I mentioned a few weeks ago, a couple of months back, when Stan Lee died, I bumped into Stan at the 2000 Democrat convention on the convention floor in Los Angeles. And I was sort of walking through, and I say it's like vague crowd, and I suddenly found myself face to face with Stan Lee, looking tanned and dapper and fabulous as ever. And I suddenly go, "Oh my God, you're a Democrat." And he beamed, and he goes, "Of course." And so I think there's conservatives risk deluding themselves over when they claim cultural phenomena as their own. National Review does this thing every couple of years, the top 40 conservative rock songs. And, you know, the things you'd expect to find are in there, George Harrison, Taxman or whatever. That's a bit like Bill Weld or Christy Whitman or George Pataki conservatism, you know, fiscally conservative and socially libertine. Nobody likes discovering they're paying 96% marginal tax rates, but that doesn't mean there's an essentially conservative worldview there. And with these big time movies, my view, as I've said before, is that all storytelling is fundamentally conservative, because it's about consequences and it's about choices. And so It's very difficult. And that's actually something that we've abolished increasingly, or the left has abolished formally in real life. So the idea is, Johnny came in this morning and he was wearing Susie's dress. So I think we might start him transitioning. Oh, yeah, sure, why not? And the idea is that these things are simply forms of self-expression, and any self-expression is good. And there is nothing that is likely to arise from that that trumps self-expression. And it's very hard, I think, to make effective storytelling out of that, although large parts of Hollywood are doing their best to do that. You know, I'd say one final thing about this, George. I was kind of bored the other night, and so I came across on one of these, it was a BBC series about 5 or 6 years ago called The Hour, about working at the BBC in the 1950s. And I didn't work at the BBC in the 1950s, but I did work at the BBC, and so I thought it might be interesting to me to watch it. And the thing it had fabulous acting. It's got a terrific cast. It's got Ben, how do you say that name? Ben Whitho, he plays Q in the new Bond films, and it's got Tim Pigott Smith and Juliet Stevenson and Dominic West as the kind of BBC newsreader, and Anna Chancellor from Four Weddings and a Funeral is the sort of tough as nails female reporter who covered the Spanish Civil War. The acting's great, and really good acting can make you forgive all the rubbish in a story. So I enjoyed the first 5 episodes. It's set during the Suez Crisis and Hungarian uprising in Budapest, 1956. I enjoyed the first 5 episodes. The 6th episode just threw it right down the toilet, the sort of lame-o politics of it. And so then I sort of thought, well, maybe that's... And then I watched the next season. Started watching the next season, and it's all this virtue signaling about the Wolfenden Report on homosexuality, where essentially people in 1950s dress have a 21st century conversation about homosexuality. And it's killing storytelling, this, because it's the deadly lack of imagination to imagine people in their own time. So you have things where they can get every period detail right. It looks beautiful, so they find the cars are right, the clothes are right, the pop songs on the soundtrack are right, but everyone is speaking and thinking with a 2019 attitude. And you see more and more so-called period drama that's like that. The inability to imagine people in their own time. And it's actually the erasure of the past. One of the reasons we do things like Tales for Our Time and our Sunday poems and some of our music specials here is because there's something really pathetic about people who, and this series, by the way, The Hour, it's called. It got rave reviews in America. The American critic, oh, this is way better than Mad Men and all this kind of thing. But it's essentially, it's people living today, making a show in which the only point of setting it in the 1950s is to virtue signal about how much more enlightened you are. And that's pathetic at a certain level, but it's also going to kill storytelling. Thank you for that question, George. I've just seen one about the name of that mayor from South Bend, Indiana. Whose name I can't even pronounce. And I'm told now that if you mispronounce his name, it's homophobic. So I don't want to even try pronouncing that name. Mark F. writes, hi, Mark. Does Donald Trump fit the fiscally liberal, socially conservative mold? He is certainly no fiscal conservative. Was that part of his success, or was it just that he talked about immigration, the decaying Midwest, and other topics that the elites decided were beyond debate? Yes, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, for a start, when you've got over $20 trillion in debt, nobody in the entirety of human history has ever been $20 trillion in the hole. And it's the old joke that if you owe the bank $1,000, you have a problem. If you owe the bank $1 million, the bank has a problem. If America owes the world $25 trillion, and that's an underestimate, if America owes the world $25 trillion, the world is a problem. So in a certain sense, it's liberating. And you see this in Washington. If you ever ask anybody in Washington, look in their eyes, what their plans are to do about the deficit in the annual budget or paying down the debt, as New Zealand does. We were mocking New Zealand, so we should actually give them credit for like paying down crown debt, public debt, in the last few years. Seriously, nobody, Canadian Liberals did that. Nobody in America has actually $25 trillion. The argument is just about how long it's going to take you to get to $30 trillion. No serious person, Republican or Democrat, in Washington, look in their eyes. None of them, even the ones who pretended to, like Paul Ryan, look in their eyes and say, well, you know, how do you have any plans to, say, get it back down to $15 trillion again? And you can see you'll be looking into dead eyes, and they're thinking, and their minders will be thinking, oh, we must get this guy out of the room. Why is he asking questions like this? And so the point for the voters is, if your rulers don't have any plans to get it down from 25 to 15 trillion, and if your rulers don't are just sort of quibbling about the rate at which you'll reach 30 trillion, why the hell should you bother about it? What's 30 trillion to you? You've got, if you get fired, if you get fired, or if you get an illness that you're stupid, whatever name, what do they call it in New Hampshire? Blue Cross Blue Shield is Anthem in New Hampshire. They've started, because Blue Cross Blue Shield became sort of unpopular, they started adopting these disguised names, like they've entered the Witness Protection Program. So they're Anthem in New Hampshire, but it's still Blue Cross Blue Shield. So if you've got one of their, you happen to get some illness and they've revised your plan and they no longer cover your illness, or you get fired, you've basically got $600. That's it. And you got a house in a dead town, and you paid $175 for it, and you'd be lucky now to get $100 for it if there happens to be anyone who wants to buy it. And somebody might come through next week, but it might not be for 2 years. And so, if the whole thing goes up, you've got $600. Why do you care? What do you care about 25 trillion? There's something, once you've blown through as much, nobody has done this. You've got to pay back 25. This is something nobody in human history has ever had to do. You have to pay back $25 trillion just to get back to being broke, just to get back to having nothing. Nobody's ever done that. And so why, if politicians, if people from Harvard and Yale and Goldman Sachs don't give two figs about it, why the hell should you? And I think that's where, I think that's one reason why, the Paul Ryan line, the fiscally conservative stuff, doesn't really go anywhere for people, Mark. But I think the other half of that as well is that when everything's lousy, And this, I think, is true in good times and bad. Culture trumps economics, right? Culture trumps economics. So you can have the Wall Street Journal view of the world, which is that man is just homo economicus. He is an economic unit. And so it doesn't matter. You need certain number of economic units to man your factory or drive your buses or whatever it is. And it doesn't matter whether that man is an Irishman or he's a Somali. And I think at a certain level, ordinary people who live in real places know that that's not so. And they grasp that the factory closes, but the mosques remain. That's the situation people are in Yorkshire. In Lancashire, in northern England, where their towns are dying and they don't even have I mean, towns are dying around me as I speak. And you go 50 miles in any direction, and unless you're in a ski resort or a college town, everything's dead in New Hampshire and Vermont, or a hospital. You get a big hospital. You got Fletcher Allen in Vermont. You got Dartmouth Hitchcock in New Hampshire. If you're near the hospital, if you're near the college, if you're near a ski resort, other than that, northern New Hampshire and northern Vermont are dead. In northern England, the towns are dead, and you don't even have the constellations of culture. So as we were talking earlier about the last French women in Clichy-sous-Bois, you're basically dying in an alien land. And that's, as I said, that's Trump intuited that. Whether he can deliver on it, of course, remains still an open question. Beth writes, it looks like, by the way, I might start a Rush has, where is his 10 favorite ladies' names. I haven't heard the name. I always used to like Beths. I've known three or four favorite Beths in my life. So I'm glad to have a fifth one along, Beth, unless you're one of those three or four that I knew many years ago. Anyway, Beth writes, it looks like the progressives are growing within the Democratic Party and have completely intimidated the so-called moderates. They've gone full-blown socialist, pro-Corbyn, anti-Israel and anti-Semitic. We are seeing eviction notices placed on Jewish students' doors at Emory University by the SJP. We are seeing Jews accused of buying politicians, and even left-wing Jews have been told to leave progressive spaces. Is it time for American Jews to be studying modern Hebrew? Well, I defer to my friends like Laura Rosen Cohen on this, who thinks that progressive Jews are basically just American liberals. That's their real religion. But I think in the broader sphere, again, it's a line of Laura's. Everybody meets at Jew Hate Junction. And one, I made this point in Commentary magazine, of all places, over a decade ago, because that is a Jewish magazine, Norman Podhoretz and John Podhoretz and all the gang. And I said that actually, when you look at polls, if you look at the way Islam and the native populations are chafing in Europe, it may indeed be the only thing they actually agree on is that is the iniquity of Israel. That's actually the only thing. And to that, we've had added since then, I think, as things have gotten crazier in large parts of the Western world, you now have elements of the resurgent right who think that the Islamization of Europe is a Jewish conspiracy. It's not. You can certainly say, and you see this, I know this from Ezra Levant calls the official Jews in Canada, that the Jews are the official Jewish organizations are incredibly stupid calculators of their own self-interest in Canada and Europe. But the idea that, so here's how it is in Toulouse. I mentioned Toulouse. They had to consolidate all the remaining synagogues, and they put it into a new synagogue just behind my hotel in Toulouse. And I walked past this five or six times. It's a windowless building with a door and soldiers outside. So I wondered what the hell it was. I thought it must be some French bureaucracy or something, but I couldn't figure out why it would have no windows in it. So on the fifth or sixth time I walked by, I said to the soldier, what is this building? And he said, it's the new central synagogue, and it has to be guarded. And we chit-chatted, and he let me in, and I went in and spoke to the guys there. And they sort of explained that in Toulouse, it's not safe for a Jew to walk about the streets in bearing identifying marks of his faith. I went up to the, which is a little ways out of town, to the Jewish school that was attacked a few years ago, and children died, and it was a horrible thing. And that school now looks like Colditz, looks like a prisoner of war camp. And I'd pass the sort of normal school, the regular French school where a regular kid gets to go, which is like 200 yards away. And it looks like it's got everything's bright colors, and the little crossing where the kids dropped off and they cross the road is all full of like bright primary coloured. It's all designed to please a child's eye. And then you go 200 yards up to the Jewish school and it looks like Colditz. And so at the same time that Jews are being forced into hiding in Toulouse, in effect, at the same time as they're being attacked, at the same time they're being doused in petrol and torched, at the same time, their museums and synagogues and cemeteries are being desecrated. They're also being blamed for having filled up Europe with the people who are doing the desecrating and the torching and the killing. So they get it coming and going because, as Laura Rosen-Cohen says, everyone meets at Jew Hate Junction. And Beth poses the question as to how... as to whether America is sufficiently exceptional for its left to be able to resist that trend. And I don't think it is. And I think actually what you see when you look at the Ilhan Omarization of the American left is that actually, you know, it's not so hard to foresee them moving in the same direction as Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party did in the UK. And it will be interesting because I've seen so many prominent British Jewish figures. Maureen Lipman, lovely actress, and just a delightful, wonderful, funny person, and had the pleasure of appearing on BBC shows with her. Sent me one of the very last things I did for the BBC. For BBC television. A couple of days later, she sent me one of the nicest postcards I've ever had from a professional colleague about any work I've ever done. And I have a lot of time for Maureen Lipman. She's been a Labour Party supporter all her life, but she's also Jewish, and she says she can't support the Labour Party now. And it will be interesting. In America, it's not going to be like that tomorrow, and it's not going to be like that next year. But the Ilhan Omarization of the Democrat Party means something. And America and the American left is not immune to the same trend that has afflicted the British and European left and all the rest. Andrew says, not sure if you saw the news, but five NHS, National Health Service clinicians in Britain, have resigned from the Gender Identity Development Service, citing concerns that the UK government's health service is putting irreversible hormone treatments on children as young as three. Do you think the tide is turning on this? I'd love to think so, but for every story like that, you can find another from Australia or Canada or elsewhere in which some 3 or 4 or 5 year olds' parents are being told that this is the right thing to do. These hormone treatments, particularly if you monkey about with children who are not yet developed, and so you're actually their natural growth is being, because they give them stuff that stops them going through puberty, for example. So, and these have consequences. So, for example, you're a boy and your doctor thinks you should transition into a girl because you've been caught in your sister's dress a couple of times. And so you're given all these treatments. Or maybe you're maybe it's not even like that. Maybe you're 12 and you genuinely think you might be happier as a female. And the trouble is, that might be so, or it might not be so. And at the age of 19 or 17 or whatever, you might decide you'd like to transition back, as a Los Angeles Times sports writer did a couple of years ago. And the trouble is, once you monkey around, and he's probably okay, the sports writer. I don't know whether he'd had the old meat and two veg chopped off or whatever. I don't know. But he was a guy who wrote a big butch sports column and then announced he was transitioning and turned his sports column into a column about his transitioning. And of course, Aside from anything else, he transitioned from being a must-read columnist into a total loser. And so eventually he decided to transition back. Now, I don't know how far he'd gone, whether he'd had the old meat and two veg chopped off or what have you. But when you do it to children, it's very hard to reverse, and the damage is permanent, that they'll never be able to conceive children, or, you know, there's all, it's actually a wicked thing. It's child abuse, it's faddism. We've had these fads before. And in fact, since you bring us to that point, Andrew, it's not unrelated to the theme of our very next Tale for Our Time, which will be starting next week, week on Friday. So I hope you'll listen to that, because it's not unrelated to that. Whether you can actually intervene in biology and create people anew. And that's one of the themes of our next Tale for Our Time, starting a week on Friday. Our current Tale for Our Time, which is Rudyard Kipling's Adventures with the Aerial Border Control, will be wrapping up a couple of hours from now, and I hope you'll join us for that. We're sort of in that thing, we're working up to our second birthday in the Mark Steyn Club. And we have, a few birthday observances, and which I hope you'll join us for. And we have our cruise coming up in September, which Dennis Miller and I talk about on Dennis's new podcast. Dennis is joining us on the cruise, and I hope you'll want to come with us. And we have a lot of other big things we're going to be doing as we enter the third year of the Mark Steyn Club. Let us know what you like about the club. Let us know what you don't like about the club. Because there's things, I don't want to do, but there's things that I might like to do that had never occurred to me until you suggest them. So whatever it is, if you've got an idea of how we can make the club more interesting, make the club more spangly and sparkling and new, do let us know. But we will be wrapping up our current Tale for Our Time tonight. We'll have a new Sunday poem for you this weekend, I believe, and we'll have a new Tale for Our Time next week, and we will then be cranking up into full gear for our second birthday observances. We hope you'll want to come along and join us for the third anniversary, for the third year of the club, and we look forward to doing a lot of new things with you in the 12 months ahead. But that is it. It is now a little after 5 p.m. North American Eastern Time. That means it's 10 p.m. in Algiers, where they're still seething in the streets about this guy. He's the Speaker of the Upper House, and they've named him interim president for, I think, 90 days. But he's going nowhere. He's a loser. They want more than that. It's 11 p.m. in Khartoum. As I said, it's not quite the Mardi, but there is the smell of unrest in the air. And the Sudanese police chief has come out on the side of the guys in the street. And it's midnight in Israel. And the process of putting together the various small parties that will give you enough to form a new government in Israel has begun. Thank you for all your questions. We always get to some of them. Either if we don't get to them here, we put the best ones and do a video edition of Mark's Mailbox. And we will see you next time.